Please be seated. This morning, the court has four causes consolidated into three oral arguments on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are as follows. Natural Gas Pipeline Company of America and others versus Joseph H. Poole and others from Moore County and the 7th Appellate District, consolidated for argument with the case that has the same name. And the second argument is Anadarko Petroleum versus Philip Thompson and others, also from Moore County and the 7th Appellate District. The final argument is the City of Bellmead Corporation versus Nanette Torres and Mike Torres, Jr., from McLennan County, the 10th Appellate District. In each of these causes, the court has allowed 20 minutes for petitioners and respondents to present oral argument. The petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and conclude these arguments by the lunch break. These arguments are being recorded, and you may purchase a tape of any argument by making application with the clerk of our court and paying a nominal fee. Justice O'Neill is not sitting in the first two oral arguments, but will join us for City of Bellmead versus Torres. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioners in Natural Gas Pipeline versus Poole.
Please, the court, Mr. Justice Pierce, will present argument to the petitioners.
Please support. I'm Jesse Pierce, and I represent the petitioners in this case consolidated around the SB's termination cases. These are unusual cases in my experience, and the judgments are troubled on several grounds. However, Texas law provides an answer to each of these problems. The first problem is a substantive problem in that profitable and productive gas leases because of some short, unexplained interruptions in production decades ago have been terminated with no legal standard, no articulated legal standard for that termination. There are several subsidiary problems that are involved here. The answer we submit is clear. The answer is found in this course. Garcia versus King and Clifton versus Coons. I'll come back and discuss the application of those rules in this case tomorrow. The second problem is really an alternative problem, and that is that in these cases, somewhere between 60 and 40 years ago, depending on which case we're looking at, there were periods in some instances 30 days, another 90 days, where there was no reported production. If we assume that the oil and gas leases terminated back in 1941 or 1963, the petitioners have been in adverse possession of the mineral estate for that entire period. In one of these cases, the jury found for the petitioners under each of the adverse possession statutes. In the other case, failed to find petitioners under any of the adverse possession statutes. However, because of the length of time, more than 25 years, petitioners are aided by a presumption under Section 16.029 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. And in fact, the Court of Appeals virtually agreed that all of the elements of adverse possession had been established with one exception, and that one exception was notice of repudiation. Now, I'll come back to that. Again, this court has a precedent in the form of the case, the opinion of Texas versus going to be available in this type of case. As I pointed out, these events in one case happened as long ago as 60 years before these suits were filed and tried. The other case, some 40 years. The court can well imagine, and the evidence is conclusive, the people who knew the answers, people who knew the facts, are long since dead. These properties have changed hands several times. Despite an effort to find some documents, find some evidence, to try to explain why in 1941 or 1955 or 1963 something happened, we could find nothing. One form of the equitable defense of latches is where the passage of time, the unexcused passage of time and the assertion of claims, renders the other party unable or disadvantaged in its efforts to defend. The Court of Appeals here simply referred to this court's opinion in Racine Enterprises versus Rogers and said, well, this is sort of like the trespass and tritidal case, therefore an equitable defense will not apply. I consider that completely wrong for several reasons. In the first place, the two cases before the court today were not pleaded, were not tried as trespass and tritidal cases. No one ever considered this had anything to do with trespass and tritidal until the Court of Appeals said, well, they're close enough to the trespass and tritidal case that we're going to apply McCain Enterprises versus Rogers. In the second place, I think common sense would tell us that unlike the traditional trespass and tritidal action, where in its purest form a court is comparing essentially two stacks of deeds and instruments, two abstracts, if you will, to determine who has the better paper title. Certainly, an equitable defense of latches, I agree, would have no place in that kind of case. In a case such as the turn on human conduct, I submit that some equitable defenses simply have to be available to allow the parties.
But these claims turn on the lease and what the lease means.
They do turn on the lease.
And this is a claim in which the plaintiffs say that title reverted to them.
That's right.
Can you cite to us any instance in which title to real property, someone's claim to it, can in fact lapse or be barred as a result of an equitable defense such as latches?
I certainly can, and I apologize for this not being in the briefs, but frankly, it didn't occur to me at the time of the briefing this. I'd refer the court to the case of Humble Oil Company versus Harrison, which is found in 205 Southwest 7355. That case, I think, clearly shows that this has been done before, and it was equitable doctrines have been applied by this court in virtually the identical situation. Humble is different only in the question there was whether delay rentals had been properly paid. As the court knows, delay rentals under many oil and gas cases are a substitute for fiscal production. If you don't have production, you may pay delay rentals and perpetuate the lease. What had happened in that case is that the people who were entitled to the royalties had made many complicated transfers among themselves, and it's frankly hard to tell, still is to me, what Mr. Harrison should have been entitled to. This court ultimately held that Mr. Harrison should have received 75% of the delay rentals. In fact, ex-Humble paid him 50%. Therefore, his delay rentals, his interest, was not properly paid. And the court pointed out, in the normal course of events, the oil and gas lease would terminate as to his interest. The exact same theory that the plaintiffs assert here. The court said, however, Mr. Harrison, because of his dealings with Exxon, was aware that Exxon was under pumped, or was under the impression that 50% was the correct delay rate. He accepted these delays. He never told pumped that he thought they were paying him incorrectly. This court applied the doctrine of equitable estoppel based on silence, based on Harrison's failure to speak
They applied estoppel as opposed to latches.
As opposed to latches.
But it was an equitable defense. Estoppel's not been an issue that's been raised in this case.
It was not raised in this case. My point is simply that an equitable defense based on conduct has been applied in a case involving legal title.
Would you now move to the temporary cessation of production issue in connection with the leases that are involved in this case?
I will, Your Honor.
I think the fundamental problem we have in this case is that the temporary cessation of production doctrine, which was born as a doctrine to mitigate against automatic termination, has in effect, at least in these opinions and a couple of others that are coming before the court or before the court, what was, and I consider that question, temporary cessation of production is an affirmative defense to lease termination. The defendant bears the burden of proof. It is a confession and avoidance defense. What has happened when we back off and look at these opinions is that the oil company, the defendant, its failure to sustain an affirmative defense becomes ipso facto the termination of the lease. And that ought not be. I'll explain how the two doctrines coexist in just a moment, but I want to talk about how the failure to meet an affirmative defense cannot itself result in termination. The rhetorical question that I have asked in the lower courts, and I think we're ultimately going to have to confront it here, is when a case comes before a district court where there is some period of zero production, be it 30 days, be it 60 days, be it a week, whatever it is, how does a court determine that this period is sufficiently long to be like the SCE? The leases in these cases, and judging from the amicus briefs in the audience and reported opinions in many other cases, don't suffer. There's no statute that says. There is no administrative rule that says. There is nowhere I submit for any court to look for guidance as to what is a long enough period.
Hasn't the doctrine, though, instead developed in the context of what caused the temporary cessation as opposed to the duration of this temporary cessation? And that if there is proof of a cause that comes within the law, then we raise the issue of whether or not the operator has, in fact, made reasonable efforts to begin production again. And so there really is a legal standard under the current doctrine, isn't there?
There is a legal standard under the affirmative. There's no question about that. It's, frankly, when you look nationally, we are a little to the very strict, harsh side of the application of the doctrine. We impose more requirements.
So is your point then not that we need look at the temporary cessation of production doctrine, but instead look at the fundamental issue of what is cessation of production sufficient to terminate a lease that would give rise to an affirmative defense?
That is exactly correct, and I submit that the answer is found in Garcia versus King. What we need to do, in my opinion, is apply the production and paying quantities doctrine. I'd like to offer two.
Not to the temporary cessation of production side of it, but to the question of whether there, in fact, has been a cessation of production.
That's correct.
Is this a significant change in Texas law?
I don't think so. This precise issue just hasn't been raised. And in fact, it looks to me like there are only two cases where it might have been possible factually for it to have been raised. It's a little hard to tell from some of the opinions. In the Midwest Oil versus Windsor case, the facts might have been such that it could have been raised. Unfortunately, Windsour was decided the same year, several months before Clifton versus Coons, and I'm just speculating, of course, I don't know if that had anything to do with it. said, yes, we ought to apply so that the production of paying quantities. That makes a lot of sense. On rehearing, they changed their mind and said, no, that has never been applied against. We're not going to apply it.
Could then the lessee, in fact, stop production for any reason under this new rule?
If the production and paying quantities doctrine were applied, arguably so, and I'd like to answer that with an example that I think is quite
valid. Your answer was arguably so, is that what you said? Okay.
And my example, I hope, will explain why I say that. Let's contrast two cases. In one case, the lessee is careful to make sure that the lease is produced some each month, enough to barely make a profit so that the lease is not vulnerable under Clifton versus Coons, but he's producing the minimum. He's holding back. Now, let's contrast that with the situation where the lessee produces all he can except in July and August, where he decides, under the allowable situation, everybody would be much better off if we overproduce our allowable, say in December and January, when the market demand is bigger and the price is higher. In the second situation, both parties receive more money. The lessor and the lessee are both economically better off by far, but the lessee loses his lease. That is an illogical result to me, particularly if one begins from the point where this court has always begun in considering this type of questions. The reasons for the lease, beautifully articulated in the Wagner Estate versus Siegler case, and also in Garcia versus Keene, the touchstone in deciding what the rule should be is the purpose of the parties in entering into which is mutual economic.
Well, what is to protect the lessor in those circumstances if, in fact, the action taken by the lessee is economically beneficial to the lessee but to the detriment of the lessor?
Well, in my second hypothetical, it would not be economically detrimental to the lessor's interest or the lessee's interest. They both might.
I know, I understand that, but there could be circumstances in which, I mean, and my understanding is that the cessation of production rule under Texas law is designed to help protect the lessor, to make sure that the lessee is in fact doing what it is required to do under the lease to produce and protect the interest of the lessor. And you've given us an example of where it would be mutually beneficial for there to be a cessation of production for economic reasons. What kind of protection would there be under this new rule for a lessor that would protect the lessor if the lessee were making economic decisions that were only beneficial to it, but to the detriment of the lessor?
The lease would be vulnerable to a lawsuit to terminate because of absence of production and paying quantities, Clifton versus Coons. This doesn't give any sort of immunity to the lessee. What this actually does is this judges all oil and gas termination cases. I'm sorry, I see my time is up. By the reasonable man standard, which is the best tool we have in our legal toolbox to deal with these cases.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
Can you please the court?
Mr. Hunt, does the rule that Mr. Pierce has proposed to us require us to change Texas law or just develop it further?
Please, of course, yes, Your Honor, it does require change.
Would you please explain what you mean?
All this court need do is apply the determinable fee doctrine to the lease language, and there's an easy explanation for what happened in this case. The result should be reached. The determinable fee doctrine is really a doctrine that's based on produce or lose. That's what the language so long has for the secondary term means, produce or lose. This court best said it in 1943 in the case of...
Well, why is that inconsistent with what Mr. Pierce just said? The example that he gave us, which has us use the standard of producing in paying quantities so that, in fact, there is production. Why is that inconsistent with the rule that you have just cited to us?
Because the determinable fee doctrine is a doctrine based on an agreement of the parties. It has been in force since actually barely 100 years. That doctrine was well expressed at this point in 1943, agreement against Magnolia Oil. And to the same kind of argument that was made in that case, this court said they could have thus met the condition which they imposed on themselves by accepting the lease. For their failure to do so, they only have themselves to blame.
Why, after 60 years, shouldn't the burden of proof at least shift to those who want to terminate the lease?
Quite the contrary, Your Honor. Let's dispel this idea that we're dealing with 60 years.
Okay, 20. In some
less than that. Let's go back to the deposition testimony of Don Marshall, an NGPL employee who explained that he found records showing that almost every lease in the Panhandle had terminated for lack of production. At the time when those records existed, NGPL had those records and could have done something about it. That's why in 1963 and 64, when 4 months went by under one lease, 5 months went by under another lease, NGPL had the ability to produce records at that time to show why there was a cessation of production.
The problem I have is no one argues that production ought to be every hour of the day. You can quit for an hour and you haven't lost the lease. You can quit for a day. I don't hear anyone arguing that a week is the appropriate time. They seem to focus on a month. Why is a month the standard by which you should judge cessation of production? Why not a quarter or half a year or a year?
For two reasons, Your Honor. Historically, the oil and gas industry has functioned on a month-to-month basis. But they don't have to. Parties are able to make contracts as they wish. It's interesting to note what the parties agreed to in this case.
Well, but they didn't specify the time period.
Oh, yes, they did, Your Honor. That's the point. The gas companies don't tell you what they agreed to back in 26 and in 35. These leases incorporated a royalty division order. And that royalty division order introduced as plaintiffs exhibit 7 in one case, plaintiffs exhibit 1B in the other case. And this division order applies to both leases because it was a consolidated lease, and then the division order applies to both leases. It spells out that payments shall be mailed only before the 15th day of each calendar month following the month in which the gas is taken. Parties agreed to operate on a month-to-month basis. When did they do that? 1935. That's why, when it became apparent in 1980, when Don Darcy was looking at these records, that there may be a significant problem with every lease in the Panhandle, that NGPL had the ability at that point in time to come forward and tell why production stop.
Mr. Hunt, I understood Mr. Pierce to say that the issue really here is that was there sufficient production that really the lessor should have at that time brought suit to claim title. Do you agree that under these leases it's the obligation of the lessor to bring suit to claim title when there's a cessation?
No, Your Honor, and this court has never in the past agreed to that. And that, Justice Hanson, is one of the changes that have to be made in the Texas law. Because under the Texas cases running from Stevens County against Kansas, when we first established the determinable fee doctrine in Texas, this court has said in those early cases and time after time. That the determinable fee doctrine works without operation of anyone coming forward. It is a termination as a matter of law because in the language of this court, the agreement, that's the bargain that the gas companies made. When the gas companies make the bargain, if we don't produce, we lose, then they have only themselves to blame. When they don't produce, and in this case, only themselves to blame, when they no longer have a record. It was explained in trial.
Mr. Hunt, why don't we look to Clifton, since under Clifton we interpret the leases in Texas to require production in paying quantities? Why doesn't that same production standard apply to the cessation of production doctrine?
It does if they were marginal production. That is, if this were a question of there being 3 days here, 2 days that month, and question of how much is being produced, when it is being produced, that's a perfect way to look to see if that well has dwindled down to the point that there should be some look to see if it's proper. But the point here is that...
But why would a lessor complain if, in fact, the lessee does not produce in July and August when prices are lower and, in fact, gets more money by producing that gas and selling it the other 10 months of the year so that at the end of the year the lessor has more money in its pocket?
That seems to be such a clarion call, but don't believe it, Your Honor, because prices are controlled.
No, my point is that it seems to me Clifton, by looking at production in terms of paying quantities, has added something to the mix. And in that regard, if there were a decision made by a lessee to cease production for a reasonable period of time to the economic benefit of both the lessor and the lessee, why should then the lease terminate under those circumstances?
Because it places great power in the hands of the gas company to manipulate what's going on for its own benefit. It changes the agreement of the parties. Parties agree. Produce or lose. And it's interesting to note that only last March, the Court of Court of Appeals had reported a case called Wynn against Ridge Oil. And there, that court correctly noted that the termination of cessation, the temporary cessation of production doctrine, doesn't apply where there is an intentional failure to produce, but it only applies where there is some unintentional failure to produce. If you have a problem with unintentional failure, or if there's something that happens at the well, collapse of the casing, breakdown of the pump, or there's some other problem, this court's opinion in 1941 in Watson against Rockmill, lessee come in and explain why there's been a problem at the well, and then have a reasonable time. It's that same reasonable time, same standard of the Clifton against Coons. But what has to trigger that is there some involuntary cessation as well.
And how was the oil company supposed to prove that? If there was an automatic termination in 1963, I understand your comment about the Dorsey affidavit, but let's take some hypothetical case. There's a termination in 1963 automatically, pursuant to your theory. How are they going to prove now in 1995 what happened in 1963? How are they supposed to prove that there was a mechanical failure? We're going to require permanent retention of documents now by all companies?
No, Your Honor. There ought to be something better than what NGPL did here. There's evidence that there is a document retention, if you prefer, or document destruction policy. Those documents, which were known to exist at the time, probably was known to exist, are gone.
I understand the facts of this case. I was talking about a hypothetical case where...
I understand. That's the reason why. If you ask me to assume facts that compel the answer, then I'm not helping the court.
Well, let's talk to the facts of this case then. In 1994, a replacement well was drilled here. Why isn't there some kind of latches or fiber argument that's compelling here?
Two reasons. Let me deal with that. First of all, latches just simply can't apply to a case in which there's a title. For the very reason that you mentioned, if the title automatically reverted down the problem.
Can you explain in economic terms why the lessors are so anxious to have these leases terminated?
Yeah, they get the leases back.
Right. I mean, this is just, this is just a question for me to understand in the background. I didn't see anywhere in the briefs. Are the royalty interests that are now being secured in contracts greater than they were in the 1930s? Or I'm just trying to understand what's going on behind the dispute. Because I suppose just having the lease back is you've still got to get somebody to operate it. You're not going to pump out the gas yourself.
Well,
the individual owner isn't.
So there still must be production of the gas that's there.
And somebody else has got to do that for you. Now, can you make a more favorable contract in today's market than people made in the 30s? Or what's going on? Are you saying you don't know? You just want to get out of these leases and then maybe you'll make a better deal, maybe a worse deal?
The practical answer is, and this isn't discussed in the record except by implication, when you're dealing with 8/8 instead of 1/8, you certainly have a bigger pie that you can pay for whatever expenses it takes to produce it. That's simply capitalism at work. And those that have a right to revert and at work claiming what is lawfully theirs. Let me go back to your question of latches. Not only shouldn't it work, or there is a title question at issue. Make no mistake, that's what happened here. Right or work, when it works, and yet the gas companies are coming back and saying, this is just a cloud on title. But what the gas companies want is the title back. There's no other way to look at this except that it is a entitlement fight.
Mr. Hunt, as I look at this, the respective rights of the parties, under the terminable fee, it looks as if when there's a cessation of production, the title reverts to the lessors.
Right.
What is left for the oil companies to do or the gas companies to do is to come in and litigate from their perspective whether or not the condition precedent occurred, which is the cessation. And as a part of that, they can come forward and show that it was excused or it was as a result of some unintended consequence of those. But they're all, the litigation is over whether or not the condition precedent occurred. It is not over whether or not some subsequent event proved an estoppel or some sort of equitable deal. It's either that condition. Here we have a case where, ordinarily, would these cases arise from the oil company bringing some sort of declaratory judgment action that it hadn't ceased? Or do these cases ordinarily only arise when the property owner, the lessor, threatens to kick the oil company off? Or in historically, how did these cases get here? Do the oil company sue or do the landowner sue?
Well, it's true that in some instances there have been suits for declaratory judgment brought by the oil and gas industry. Typically, these suits are brought by royalty owners saying, we are now the owners of 8/8. We are the mineral owners, and we are entitled under the determinable fee doctrine to the whole of the mineral estate bank.
Are you suing for damages for the 7/8 wrongfully withheld? And you agree with the Court of Appeals that that's subject to limitations?
Yes.
So you've got a 4-year claim?
2 years. We've got 2 years of damages, and that's it.
Should the lessor have to reimburse the lessee for improvements to the lease that have incurred it has done during this time period? For example, if they drilled another well?
If the court wished to apply some sort of latches standard and most it could do, as respectfully suggested, is to let the company recover the cost of that well. But let me go back.
My point, Mr. Hunt, is that you say that the lessee should be responsible for this because they know they stopped production, but you rely on the division order to tell us that a month is the period of time you're looking at, which means they were getting monthly checks, which means the lessees at the time knew they weren't getting checks in certain months, but they did nothing. And yet we now have the lessees incurring expenses. For example, let's say they drilled a new well during this interim. And yet the lessor steps up 20 years, 40 years later and says, thank you very much, that's mine, I'll take it now. So there's a little bit of tension, it seems to me, in terms of the period of time when you rely on the division order for monthly payment information at the same time you're saying this all lies in the hands of the lessee. How are we going to deal with that tension?
Your Honor, the best way to deal with the tension is to let the parties have the contract they made. The contract that was made here was produce or lose. There was no production. Well, it's an easy answer to say, well, the mental owners must have done it because they didn't get a check that month. But the mental owners are not nearly as sophisticated. But that's not the issue. This is a matter of law. Either it reverts or it doesn't. If it reverted back then and the landowners didn't discover the reversion until much later, that legal title still reverted as a matter of law back then.
I understand the argument. I mean, if I'm the legal title holder, unless there's adverse possession, I can't lose it just because I don't keep asserting periodically that I own it.
How
disastrous would it be, though, for the court to go look at this reverter as a matter of law issue and say there is no reverter as a matter of law unless there is a condition which is the secession? And if that's the provision that the lessor asserts occurred, what would be wrong with the court saying that really the appropriate process should be for the lessor to bring a lawsuit to claim title? Well, all of this would simply go away. You wouldn't have a laches problem. You wouldn't have any other problem because the lessor would be required to bring the claim within a reasonable period of time of their claim that the secession occurred. How difficult would that be for the parties in these kinds of arrangements to get the relationship correct?
Of course, Your Honor, this court has the power to make that fundamental change in Texas law. But be sure what the change is. It is a change that was rejected by this court and has been rejected continually throughout the years. It is going to a condition subsequent. It is a destruction of the determinable fee doctrine in Texas. It is a destruction on which the rights of gas companies and mineral owners depend for vested rights that have come down through the years.
Would you answer Mr. Pierce's claim that the Johnson case would allow adverse possession under these facts?
The Johnson case?
You said Texas Western versus Johnson.
That's an easily answered decision because what that involved is 96 acres along with 56 other acres in East Texas. A mortgage, G, had a mortgage, deed of trust mortgage on the 96 acres. In 1921, that mortgage foreclosed on that property. There was an involuntary foreclosure at the courthouse steps. Trustees deed recorded in the deed records, and so there wasn't any question. But what there was a new owner in town at the courthouse, there was someone who was in the position of actively, adversely claiming it. The new owner didn't ever come in and dispossess. That's the distinction there. There is no change of title here that is recorded at the courthouse that all know. In the end, the determinable fee doctrine should be kept applied. Judgment affirmed.
What do we do like with continuous drilling clause? Let's suppose it's been 40 years since the wells were originally drilled and records are lost, but someone who was out there at the time comes and says, well, I remember I kept calendar there was a more than a 60-day lapse in between drilling for the wells and the lease should have terminated, but the landowner was happy that the well came in and didn't know any better. But what do you do with those kind of cases where people come in way after the fact and say, well, I think I remember this. I mean, do we say that the lease terminated under the continuous drilling clause 40 years ago?
You may well do that, but you depend instead on the wisdom of juries to recognize a fact issue made and lawyers on each side coming in and making the argument that the jury, you should reject this claim that's many years ago that is so weakly based on these old memories.
We put limitations on just about everything else. Why shouldn't we impose some sort of time limit in these cases, if you think your lease is terminated, to go into court and get that resolved.
If you want to do that prospectively, you can, Your Honor. The court has that power. But it ought not to destroy the vested rights of property owners in Texas Town who have contracted with respect to leases and leasehold property, who have right of reverters that are at issue. If the reverter happened and you don't find out about it till later, it is still a reverter as a matter of law. Simply because you haven't claimed your property legally doesn't take that property away from you, unless, as in TexLease, there is a clear indication of the party in possession that they're claiming against that new owner. That's the distinction. That's why adverse possession will work in most cases where there is a clear repudiation. There was in TexLease. There's not here.
I know a case where you claim you've rightfully owned the property for 40 years, and there have been several new wells drilled since then on the property. Is there? Does the lessee have any claims to quantum merit or some other claim for the benefits given to your property under a mistaken impression of law?
May well have a claim. If a lessee has such a claim, let the lessee assert it. And there's no reason why someone who has benefited another's property in good faith can't recover some of that. But that's not the issue here, happily. We don't have to decide that. You certainly have to take it into account as a matter of policy in the decision that you make. But to decide this case based on the determinable great principles and what the parties agreed to in 1926-1935. In the end, judgment should be affirmed.
Mr. Hutt, before you sit down, let me go back to Justice Heck's question earlier, which also bothers me, and the question of the no time period. And I know you referred us to the division orders and say that because royalties were to be paid monthly, that indicates that a month is long enough. But why should it be a month? I mean, tell me what time period we should be looking at, which seems to be a fundamental problem with the cessation of production doctrine.
There are two issues there, and let me cover them again. First of all, where there is an intentional failure to produce, the temporary cessation production doctrine is not triggered.
I'm back at cessation of production before we flip over to the lessee saying I have a legal excuse.
Well, I understand the question. What I'm trying to say, though, is that you look first to see why it stopped, if that is an issue. If there is an intentional cessation, that ought to take place in a month, 2 months, because the industry and the parties operate on a month-to-month basis. And that's what they contracted to do. Produce each month, pay each month.
But if the economics really require looking at a larger period of time than just a month in terms of making decisions as a prudent operator, then why should we be restricted to a month? If I could produce the well in September and get more for the gas rather than in August, and I'm trying to act as a reasonably prudent operator in the way I run the lease, why should the time period be restricted to a month?
Because it places too much economic power in the hands of the gas companies. Let me point this out. These leases are unique because they're old, and there's no savings clause in any of these. Person most likely to be the number one draft choice in the NBA will likely be a high school student who will have an agent and the best attorneys around. Gas companies can surely, with all their powerful attorneys, can come forward and draft leases that take care of this problem. But as the leases now stand, these fees terminated.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Pierce, before you sat down earlier, you said that it was up to the lessors to sue to claim their title. Now, is that the basic premise of your client, that the real reason that they believe they win here is because it's up to the lessor to sue to reclaim their title when there's been a cessation of production?
I think if we apply the cessation and reduction in pay and quantity doctrine, it is incumbent. That was the question I was trying to answer Justice Sanders.
So it's not a condition. So there is not an automatic reverter when there's a cessation of production. There is not an automatic reverter.
As the law now stands, it is that a cessation of production results in the termination of the determinable fee interest in the minerals. The question is, what is that cessation? And while the question is not before the court in this case, frankly, I don't consider it an argument of reductio ad absurdum to suggest that there may be a day in some court in this state where somebody is going to stand up and say, we've got a month period here. This lease is terminated.
They believe they win here is because it's up to the lessor to sue to reclaim their title when there's been a cessation of production.
I think if we apply the cessation in production and paying quantity doctrine, it is incumbent. That was the question I was trying to answer of Justice Hankins.
So there is not an automatic reverter when there's a cessation of production. There is not an automatic reverter.
As the law now stands, it is that a cessation of production results in the termination of the determinable fee interest in the minerals. The question is, what is that cessation? And while the question is not before the court in this case, frankly, I don't consider it an argument reductio ad absurdum to suggest that there may be a day in some court in this state where somebody is going to stand up and say, we've got a month period here. This lease is terminated. Or we have a week period, or for that matter, a day period, where nobody can say why they intentionally turned this well off.
And I take it more timely bringing a suit would not resolve that issue. You'd still have to resolve that issue.
You would have to resolve that issue. You'd have the benefit of some living, breathing witnesses, maybe some documents. And there's really no need for this. Clifton versus Coons was at pains, this court in Clifton versus Coons was at pains to point out there is no arbitrary time period.
What about leases that have a 60-day clause in them?
Those leases will be taken care of by their language, with one possible exception. If the 60-day clause is triggered by a cessation of production, as was true in Clifton versus Coons, we could still be in this situation. If you applied an automatic ipso facto termination, would a day be enough?
Well, let me ask you, I'm still trying to explore this. As I understand it, if there's a cessation of production, the title automatically reverts.
In any case, oil and gas lease, grant of real property, any fee simple determinable, there is some condition that is the limitation. When that limitation occurs, there is an automatic reverter.
So now we're fighting over the oil company's right to be on the property.
That's correct.
Does the oil company have the duty to prove that the condition precedent did not occur? Or does a landowner who has this automatic reversion have to establish that the condition precedent occurred?
As matters now stand, there's no question about that in this case, for example, there was at least a 30-day cessation of production. That's what the Railroad Commission records show. I have no way to dispute that. So the event under present law is established. There is an affirmative defense that is sometimes available, which is the temporary cessation of production.
So the gas company has the burden to prove that the condition preceding did not occur. Now,
no,
you're saying as a matter of law, because the 30-day
did,
but I'm trying to find out, if you're going to say the reversion did not occur, then it's up to the oil company to prove those facts to establish that the reverter didn't occur.
To prove an affirmative defense, an acceptable reason for cessation of production. Under existing law now, if there is no production, the problem is...
I'm sorry, I don't mean, I'm not arguing, but I'm trying to get the concept here.
Sure.
If you prove the affirmative defense, does that not establish that the reverter did not occur?
That's
the
correct.
The condition preceding did
the
not occur.
The oil company wins in that instance.
So the effect of it is the oil company has given has the burden to establish that the condition preceding did not occur under established law. You say there's this secession occurred, but that's simply the prima facie showing, but the oil company does have the authority to come in and prove that it, as a matter of fact, the secession, the condition did not occur that resulted in the reverter.
There is a legal excuse for that secession.
Now, over 60 years later, the assertion that title reverted 60 years ago, the oil company claims, wait a minute, they ought to be stopped equitably from doing that because we cannot now prove that that condition preceding or our defense to that condition preceding didn't occur.
That's quite correct. I cannot establish why there was a 30-day cessation of production in 1941 during the Second World War.
But the prima facie event occurred.
There was a 30-day cessation of production in 1941.
And so the title, by prima facie evidence, reverted. You are asking that some sort of equitable rule be imposed that then retransfers title, or what does it now do?
I think that the equitable defense of latches and estoppel should be recognized and should be available, at least in these kind of facts. What I'm really asking, and if I may make this point by pointing out that, let's talk about our 30-day cessation of production in 1941. Had the gas company gone out and produced that well for 1 hour, one day, that month, a totally different legal test would apply, totally different burden of proof, and in this kind of case, almost as a matter of law, a different result. I don't think that makes much sense unless we're to say that's how our forefathers did it, it's good enough for us.
Mr. Hunt says that if we develop the law further, as you would have us do with respect to the concept of cessation of production, that in fact we will be ignoring the intent of the parties to the original lease. Would you respond to that?
I would, and I would cite the court to the Wagner Estate versus Sigler case, Garcia versus King. My experience is most legal rules have reasons. There are reasons that these rules developed if you dig back far enough. And in those two opinions, this court will find those reasons. These doctrines exist to further the purposes of the parties, which is mutual economic benefit. The landowner says, I'll give up the rights to the minerals. I'll let you come on my land as long as it's to my economic benefit. That has always been this court's touchstone in deciding what the law ought to be, and that is in no jeopardy if the court does what I'm suggesting.
Would this, if there was a shut-in royalty for clause, is that?
There is no shut-in royalty
I know
clause
not,
in this
but
case.
But is that the only, if there was, this problem would never come up or almost never?
Well, I got to get outside the record a little bit. The reason I hesitate is the court may know there are a number of these cases. Sometimes proving the payment of a shut-in royalty is a very difficult issue, and it's a little ironic because under existing law, that's the lessor's burden to prove that no shut-in royalty was paid.
When did those clauses become common?
They apparently became more common in the, I'd say in the 40s, though I haven't really made a study.
Are there a whole lot of existing leases that predate the 40s in the Panhandle?
In the Panhandle, and not only in the Panhandle, elsewhere. Frankly, one of my biggest concerns when I was drafting the petition for review might be that the response would be, well, this is a very limited problem. It really doesn't have much impact on statewide jurisdiction or jurisprudence. I think that is certainly not true. I could gather more than a half dozen of these opinions that are working their way up here right now.
And
this is a live issue.
Are all the Railroad Commission records, okay. Railroad Commission has 100% retention rate for what
of records on what happened from the 30s to the present?
They have apparently a pretty good record that goes back at least, frankly, I don't know how far back it goes. The retention problem, and I'd like to answer this because this is something that the court seems troubled about and needs to know. Why do these cases get here? Why do we have these cases? What's happened, and this is in the record and in the briefs, is that there are people who go out and go through these Railroad Commission records. They find months of zero production. They contact the heirs of the original lessors and say, you've got quite a lawsuit here. Assign me a third of it. I'll get a lawyer and we'll pursue it.
But the existence of Railroad Commission records, at least the existence at the time and for some time thereafter, is critical to your latches and adverse possession arguments.
It is.
Is this a national problem as well? What is occurring in other jurisdictions, and how do they define cessation? And what's the majority rule if there is one?
I would say that Texas, and I'll give you a citation, 100 ALR 2nd 885. It's a 1963 annotation. It is, in my opinion, a little deficient on analysis, though it does collect the cases. The substantive law of various states is different. Oklahoma, for example, the interest is not a determinable fee, but a profit a prandre. So there are some differences that make it hard to do a head count like we might with the question of, say, whether contributory negligence is a defense to some claim. Generally speaking, the temporary cessation doctrine is applied, but it is applied with a little more, leavened by a little more equity, if you will. It is more what was this reasonable? Did the party act reasonably? Was there a reason they did what they did? Did they get production restored? And you kind of suggest, is anybody really hurt? Like in this case, or my second hypothetical, where the lessor ends up better off.
With respect to your theory of focusing on paying production, the idea that a lessee would say, look, let's wait till December and produce more then because it will be mutually beneficial to both of us is a compelling one. But what's to keep the lessee from saying, let's wait till 2005 because the gas prices right now are low winter and summer, and we should just wait and bide our time?
The longer the period is stretched, the more vulnerable the lease will be under Clifton versus Koontz. Clifton versus Koontz, again, this court made it very clear, there is no arbitrary absolute period to look at. You submit that to the jury. If, for example, someone knew that 13 months from now, a gas plant, processing plant, is going to be completed in the next county, and we can get twice as much for this gas, I submit it might be determined to be reasonable to wait until that plant's available.
Wouldn't it be better for everybody to have a hard and fast rule?
Pardon?
Wouldn't it be better for everybody in the industry to know in advance what the consequences of their actions are going to be?
It would certainly be simpler, but in the production and paying quantities, we don't have a hard and fast rule. It is submitted to the jury under the reasonably prudent operator standard. And the operator essentially gets to come in and explain why it did or didn't do what occurred.
Well, what about your answer to Justice Heck's question, under Watson, didn't we hold that unfavorable market conditions wouldn't justify non-production?
Watson was a 2-year, 7-month, I believe, period where there was no production at all, because the gas market had gotten so bad and the oil was of such low quality. I think any doctrine, and again, depending on the facts, there's always a point where a court is entitled to say, and sometimes must say, as a matter of law, you've gone past the limit. I think Watson was correctly decided on different facts. I don't know what the result would be.
Final question, Mr. Hunt, sure. At least alluded to the fact that some of these leases had long-term fixed price contracts?
No, the leases. The leases do not.
So there will be a seasonable variation.
That's correct. The natural gas pipeline company was an interstate pipeline whose prices were regulated by the Federal Power Commission back at this period. And that's why I haven't made the argument that somehow that motivated this conduct. I'm talking about this court writing for the industry and considering hypothetically what could happen, and that's a very real possibility today.
Under your adverse possession theory, what title does the lessee get? Is it going to be, it can be title outright? Does the determinable fee continue?
It is titled to a 7/8 mineral interest.
But still the determinable fee?
No, it owns the minerals outright to the extent of 7/8. The reason for that is no one of the petitioners ever considered that they owned the 1/8 royalty interest.
You're using the adverse possession doctrine in order to defend against the claim that title reverted.
It's the only curative doctrine or defensive doctrine.
Right, and my question is the title obtained by adverse possession of the same nature as the title the lessee originally received under the lease, or is it a different nature?
It is a complete and whole fee simple title to a 7/8 mineral interest.
And that's because they never claimed the 1/8.
They never claimed the royalty interest, and it'd be disingenuous.
They're no longer bound by the lease terms. They own it outright.
That's correct. And in fact, this precise point is made at the very end of the St. Louis royalty case, that old Fifth Circuit adverse possession case that cited the case.
It sounds like we've swung the pendulum then entirely the other direction under the adverse possession theory. Because the lessor comes out on the other end with a whole lot less than what they had, what rights they would have under the lease for the 7/8.
The consequences of not timely asserting that claim.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes argument in the first cause. We'll take a brief recess.